Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's near meltdown in the Oval Office in front of the President of Finland after he had tried to dodge a simple question from Jeff Mason of Reuters, who asked what it was that Trump wanted from the Ukrainian president. But when asked again to answer the actual question, Trump went full on Robert De Niro from the movie Taxi Driver. Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me? Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University and the author of Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, joins us to discuss the possibility that Trump might not leave the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, but rather have a public meltdown on TV as the Howard Beale character did in the movie Network. And while Trump appears rattled by the impeachment, which has just started, we'll speculate whether his behavior will get more unhinged as the pressure and evidence mounts. However, Dr. Francis warns that our president, who is essentially a two-year-old prone to tantrums, knows his base and how to talk to them. And he could get reelected unless there is a mass mobilization of concerned and disgusted Americans who get out to vote in overwhelming numbers, whether or not the Democrats stop wasting money arguing amongst themselves. Because once they've picked a candidate and the general election begins, the Democrats will be massively outspent by Wall Street and brutally vilified by Trump and Fox News. Then we'll speak with one of the country's finest writers and leading environmental thinkers, Jedediah Purdy, a professor of law at Columbia Law School, whose latest book just out is This Land Is Our Land, The Struggle for a New Commonwealth. He joins us to discuss what it means to belong to the land, a country, a nation, a place, and what it means to live with others on it at a time of renewed nationalism and nativism. We'll explore how we might begin to heal our fractured and contentious relationship with the land and with each other. Then finally, with Putin making a joke of whether he will interfere with our 2020 elections by whispering conspiratorially, "I'm going to tell you a secret. Yes, sure, we're going to do that, but don't tell anybody." We'll go to the UK to speak with one of the foremost Russia watchers today, Mark Galeotti, whose latest book is We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong. He joins us to discuss how Putin is not a great strategist, but rather a skilled judo player who goes after our weaknesses instead of building on Russia's strength, because he and his cronies are robbing the country blind. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book just out is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Great pleasure to be back with you.
Well, thank you. And I've often speculated on whether or not Donald Trump would leave the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket. But I've often said for some time now that my sense is that he may actually have a public meltdown on television, as he almost did yesterday in front of the president of Finland. And the analogy or the comparison would be to the Peter Finch character in the movie Network. So what did you think about yesterday's Oval Office near meltdown?
Well, by the way, that's my favorite movie, and everyone should watch it as a great predictor of so many things happening today. I think Trump is best understood not as a mental patient so much, but as a baby, a temper tantrum-prone baby who's always gotten his way. He's been enabled and rewarded every step of the way in his life, despite the outrageousness of his behavior. And I think we have to look less to him. He's certainly likely to be more and more dangerous as he's threatened increasingly with public humiliation and removal from office. The real responsibility now, because we can expect only the worst for him in the future, the real responsibility lies with whatever grown-ups are left in the room, whoever has the integrity in the Republican Party to stand up at this crucial moment in our history and say enough is enough, that our country is more important than our party, that losing democracy is a real and present danger at this point, and that I'm going to do what's right. And so far, we've discovered, to our great regret, that not one single Republican has stood up and done what needs to be done. This is not a time for summer soldiers and for sometime patriots. This is a time when our country's at great risk. And I think the only hope, I think Trump could very well win the next election, regardless of his behavior. He said before this election that he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and he wouldn't lose his voters. And I think that it's absolutely remarkable to me. I predicted most of what Trump's done. His psychology is completely transparent. But it's absolutely remarkable to me that 35 to 45% of the American public is willing to go along with this. And the crucial question for this next election is whether there's anything Trump can do that's so outrageous that it will sufficiently enrage his supporters. I don't expect the greedy ones, the billionaires, to get off the gravy train. I think they'll accept any Trump behavior so long as they can retain their tax breaks and deregulation. I don't expect the hypocritical evangelical religious leaders to get off Trump. I think they've sold their souls to this Antichrist, and they will ride him to perdition. I don't expect the white supremacists to get off Trump. I think that he's their dream come true. The question, the crucial question for our country is whether there are still Republican voters who have the intelligence and the integrity to realize there's more at stake than partisan tribalism, and that we have to save our country before it becomes just another banana republic.
Well, you're quoted at length in an article in The Atlantic by George Conway, who is the husband of Kellyanne Conway, who's a close aide of Trump's, and we all know about how strange it is that he's, the husband is one of the most, been one of the most trenchant critics of Trump. And in terms of where you're quoted here, the article mentions the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, otherwise known as the DSM. And how does that relate to Trump in terms of the way that he's being diagnosed, not necessarily in the media, if you will, in spite of this so-called Goldwater rule?
Well, I think there's been a well-meaning effort to give him a psychiatric diagnosis with the hope that this might in some way impair his ability to get away with his behaviors. I think it's inaccurate and misguided and in some ways fundamentally unfair to the mentally ill. The mentally ill are, for the most part, well-behaved, well-meaning people. Trump is neither. And to be lumped with Trump is to do a great disservice to them. It stigmatizes them to be joined together with this horrible, evil individual. I prefer to see Trump much more as an evil person than as a crazy person. Much more, as I said before, a spoiled brat, a crook, a con man, a dictator wannabe, rather than someone who's mentally ill. Three diagnoses have been offered for Trump. One is he's demented. I think that this greatly underestimates his cleverness. In some ways, he's crazy like a fox, and some of the things that seem most outrageous to reasonable people play very well to his base. And I think he really has to keep his base intact at this point, because if he loses them, he loses everything. And his play will be to cheat, to con, to instill anger and dissent throughout the country to get the base out in the next election. So a lot of things that look demented are really clever political ploys, evil, but clever political ploys. Some people claim he's delusional, but to be delusional, you have to be a minority of one or a very small group. Trump is a conspiracy theorist. We don't know whether he believes these conspiracy theories or whether he's just using them. It doesn't really matter one way or the other. When you have 40% of the American public believing the same stupid and dangerous things you believe, you're no longer delusional in the way the public is. And we have to worry about our craziness and letting this man govern us rather than attribute craziness to him. I think the diagnosis that makes sense is narcissistic personality disorder. He's probably one of the great narcissists, not just for our time, but for the ages. We have to go back to some of the Roman emperors to find people as grandiose and as lacking in empathy as he is. But at this point in his life, up until this point in his life, maybe it'll be different now, but up until this point in his life, his narcissism, his grandiosity, his lack of concern for others, his self-promotion, his exploitation of others for his own evil ends, all this has been terrifically rewarded, not punished. He became president of the United States, being one of the most narcissistic people to have ever lived. So it's less seeing it as a psychiatric disorder and more as a horrible character trait. And again, if people want a metaphor for Trump, it's a two-year-old who's willing to do anything in the world to get his way in a temper tantrum. And one of the things I worry about is that as he goes down, he will do his best, as Hitler did, to take everyone down with him.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. So given what you've just told us, Dr. Francis, it would seem that being president of the United States is the worst thing that could happen to a two-year-old prone to tantrums, because he's waited on hand and foot all day long, is he not? He has a big airplane. He has people, butlers, sycophants. He's got sycophants like the Secretary of State stroking him and all this kind of stuff. So he's the worst. Somebody with that condition, that's the worst job. It reinforces grandiosity, does it not?
Yeah, he was a pretty terrible person to start with. And the enabling of his worst instincts and impulses through the power that we've given him is certainly likely to bring out even more horrible behavior in the future than we've seen already. I think that Trump is as deviant as a human being can be from norms, but he's deviant on a moral dimension, not a mental illness dimension. And I think that the only way to contain someone like Trump, a con man and a baby, is to set very strong societal limits. And that's my great disappointment. I had expected Trump to do everything he's done. I had not anticipated that the Congress would be so enabling, that the Supreme Court would be so enabling, that the media, especially Fox News, would be so enabling, and that the public would maintain this level of support through all the things he's done. Now, we have to realize that Trump understands his public a lot better than we do. So when he said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, he was right. We were wrong. And so far, he's maintained the support of what we would have hoped would be an informed citizenry. The fact that he represents a 50-year effort on the part of the Republican Party to forge the coalition that's supporting him, the fact that tin pot dictators are taking over in many other countries of the world, and right-wing parties are becoming increasingly powerful in a number of otherwise civilized democratic countries. All this tells us is that democracy is a very fragile fruit. It's existed for very short periods of time in very few countries in the history of civilization. And unless people stand up and support our democracy, this will have been an experiment that may last no more than 250 years.
Well, Dr. Francis, you mentioned how difficult it is to pry Trump loose from his base, who are living in the Fox News bubble where they're immune to facts and information. But now that his behavior is so, particularly based upon what happened yesterday in the Oval Office with the president of Finland, where he sort of imitated Robert De Niro in the movie Taxi Driver, you know, you're talking to me, to the reporter. It was all just so strange. And most commentators are seeing it as being almost unhinged. the impeachment is just beginning. And as Nancy Pelosi said just yesterday, Trump is scared. So if he's behaving this way at the beginning of an impeachment, as more and more evidence comes out in the course of the next couple of months, and the evidence out there is appalling. If only they dug into his criminal past with the Russians, laundering Russian mob money, KGB stolen funds, how they've owned him, the Russians, since 1987. And whenever he gets into trouble, the Russians funnel money through Deutsche Bank. I mean, it's not just that he's an evil person, he's also a traitor. So, you know, if the evidence gets out there, and as I say, it's only just beginning the impeachment, and he's behaving in this semi-unhinged way, wouldn't that suggest that as the pressure mounts on him, he's going to get more and more unhinged?
Well, I've been worried all along, ever since I wrote the book, that Trump would start a war as a distraction. The great movie here is Wag the Dog, also with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, in which a president in trouble and down at the polls begins a fake war in order to regain re-election. And I think it's very likely that Trump will use all sorts of diversionary techniques. I think he's going to do his best to blame the coming recession on the Democrats because of the impeachment, or the Federal Reserve because it won't blow up the economic bubble that's about to burst. I think he will be desperate. I think he will have no loyalty to the people around him. He's already throwing Pence under the bus. The question isn't really Trump. I think we can expect the worst of him. The question is us. And I think Congress, I've suggested now for years, that Congress should have passed an act clarifying who presses the nuclear button and under what conditions to prevent him from starting a nuclear war. It should pass an act clarifying that the Constitution requires congressional approval for any declaration of war. And I think that the Congress must do its best belatedly to set limits to his arrogant, impulsive, increasingly unpredictable, and totally dangerous behavior. With Nixon, it was the senior Republicans who finally went to Nixon's office and said, time's up. We don't have senior Republicans so far with the courage or the integrity to do this. And when will the Mitt Romneys and the other people who sort of fancy themselves as more reasonable finally say enough is enough? We don't know. If it doesn't happen soon, it may be too late.
And just to touch on, Dr. Francis, on what you were saying earlier about how when Trump said he could shoot people in on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, that his base understood it, but the rest of us didn't, and we still don't get it. Is that to say that his latest peculiar twist and turn today, where on camera he essentially repeated the shakedown that he did with the Ukrainian president by inviting the Chinese to investigate the Bidens? So a lot of people are saying, well, that's just, you know, he's digging the hole deeper. So, but what is the crazy like a fox explanation for that in terms of his base?
Well, I think that people like us really don't get Trump and don't get the people who do get Trump. He was a reality TV star for 10 years with a show that probably you and I never watched. He understands that audience, the kind of wrestling and, you know, wild martial arts audience, better than we do. What seems to us to be an unhinged, horrible display of infantile behavior may seem in other circles to be he's telling it like he is. He may be actually acting as a lot of people would like to act and usually keep within themselves. So that he hasn't, but the polls show that although his approval rating has gone down a little bit, it has gone down much. His approval rating now, low as it is not much different than lots of presidents at this point who are decent, dignified people doing their jobs. There is a large minority of people in the United States for whom Trump can do no wrong. And that's why we mustn't underestimate the very real possibility that despite all of this, he could win re-election. They will cheat like crazy in this campaign. They will have lots more money because even the Democratic big Wall Street money is turning towards Trump because they don't want Elizabeth Warren. They fear her more than they fear Trump. They will be flooding. This election will be won in just a few districts of the United States. They will be flooding those districts with horrible lies. They will have great assistance from all sorts of bad actor parties within the United States and outside the United States. So I think one of the real dangers now is, as we see him acting in a more and more bizarre way to us, that we underestimate the fact that this may play well to his most favorite audience, and that we could wind up with another 4 years of Trump that would be absolutely disastrous. I think it's incumbent on everyone to stop psychological name-calling, to stop feeling sorry for ourselves, and to get out there and get out the vote. This election won't be about changing minds so much as it will be about getting bodies into the polling booth. And I think we have to register the college students, the high school students who are about to become a voting age. We have to be working in the Latino churches. We have to be working in the black churches. The Democrats have to stop fighting internecine battles that are destructive to credibility and wasting lots of money that could be used for the general election. We need a winning candidate, and it can be anyone but Trump, and everyone has to join together. The Republicans tend to join together even for a candidate they didn't like. Trump was not popular with two-thirds of the party until he won the nomination. The Democrats tend to splinter even though all the candidates are pretty reasonable. And this has been a general tendency on the left to divide, on the right to join forces. We have to reverse that for this election. We have to get everyone on board and everyone working full blast. Because I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it's not just our democracy, it's the climate of the world, it's the future of our kids and our grandkids, that this planet is fragile, that our democracy is fragile, and Trump is very much a bull in the china shop.
Well, just in closing, since we do have a kind of Kardashian culture, which Trump fits very well into, and her, of course, Kardashian's husband is one of his only few fans, certainly in the African-American community. And we've also had our politics under Trump have more and more resembled the Jerry Springer show. And that is what the base likes. You referred to the wrestling metaphor, which I think is equally as appropriate as the Jerry Springer situation. That seemed to have started when John McCain chose Sarah Palin. It was an invitation for people who may in the past have voted for people that they thought were more qualified and better educated than they were. But nowadays, people seem to be voting for people who were just like them. So if that's a correct analysis, how do you deal with the cultural shift? Because when people like the historian John Meacham calls for our better angels, are there enough better angels left? How much is our culture being coarsened by the Jerry Springers of this world and the Donald Trumps?
Well, let's not forget that just 10 years ago, America elected Barack Obama, a black man, a rational man, a decent human being. So that, and let's not forget that Trump lost the election by over 3 million votes and still became president because of the way the Electoral College works. I think that this election, Trump will undoubtedly be swamped on the popular vote. I doubt that he'll come within 5 million votes, whoever the Democratic candidate is. The way things are structured and the way the Republicans have gerrymandered, he can win, even if he loses by 5 million votes. And that's why we can't worry so much about the Trump psychology. We can't worry so much about the fact that a large part of American culture is highly uncivilized and uncultured. We can't worry about the sins of the past. We have to get out the vote. It's as simple as that. I think that people have to stop thinking and start doing and pound the streets, get on the phone lines, work with local party apparatus, help to bring the party together, quickly get to one candidate, develop a shadow cabinet amongst the other candidates so that they can play a role in the election. This is the moment of truth, and I hope that the Democratic Party can rise to it.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Alan Francis. He's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now in an updated paperback version. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with one of the country's greatest writers and leading environmentalists about his new book, This Land is Our Land, The Struggle for a New Commonwealth.
I hope he's riding ahead. I hope he's riding ahead. I hope he's riding ahead, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's riding ahead. I hope he's riding ahead. I hope he's riding ahead, even if he had to wrong someone.
A blind man on the plains. I drink my water when it rains and live by chance among the lightning strikes. Oh, once I held a glacier to a huddle.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jedediah Purdy, who's a professor of law at Columbia Law School and a contributing writer at The New Yorker, The Nation, The New Republic, and The Atlantic. And his books include After Nature, A Tolerable Anarchy, Being America, and his latest book just out is This Land is Our Land, The Struggle for a New Commonwealth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jedediah Purdy.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here with you.
Well, thank you, Jedediah. And your new book looks into what it means to belong to a land, a country, a nation, a place, and what it means to live with others on it at a time of renewed nationalism and nativism. And it also explores how we might begin to heal our fractured and contentious relationship with the land and with each other. Not exactly a modest undertaking, Jedediah.
No, you try to write a book, I guess, that's at least in some way on the scale of the times, and the times are very serious.
Well, isn't the drama here, the ticking clock, isn't the drama here that as much as the challenge that we've just enunciated of healing this nation and healing the divide and learning how to live with the land, what's looming is, of course, is that global warming will make things so much more radically worse that we won't have the luxury of civility. People will be shooting each other over a can of tuna.
That's exactly the worry on two levels, I guess. One is that we don't have time. We don't have time to wait out a Supreme Court that might invalidate climate change legislation, for example, or God knows what else. We don't have time to wait out a second Trump administration because political time is now moving more slowly than geological time. I realized when my son was born a month ago that in the years between my birth and his birth, global carbon levels went up more than through all recorded human history up to that time. Which is to say the pace of climatic crisis is now moving faster than the pace of human life, cultural life, political life. We've always assumed the world is in the background. It'll go on while we deal with our crises in the foreground. But now it's moving faster than we are, and in a way it's coming for us. So that's one point about time. And the second, your point about the social crisis that comes with climate change. I think this is also exactly right. It's a very important part of the argument in the book. The terrible thing about climate change, as a friend of mine put it to me recently, is not that nature is going to come to kill us in a simple way. The terrible thing is the horrible things that we may do to each other under more environmentally stressed and scarce circumstances. So I'll make that a little more concrete in terms of the climate politics of the Trump administration. I think it's a denialist administration, but denialism means something different now than it meant in the early days of the Koch brothers campaign or Exxon's disinformation campaigns about climate change. Denialism used to mean rejecting the facts and trying to avoid acknowledging that ecological crisis was really happening. For Trump and for the new right-wing nationalisms generally, denialism is more about denying the ethical, the moral implications of climate change. Whatever Trump thinks, whatever these right-wingers think about the science, they're not denying that all the things we're worried about are happening. Increased displacement, increased refugee flows, water scarcity, extreme droughts, things that are driving people around the world, driving people across borders. What they're denying is that it's our problem. They're denying responsibility beyond your borders or even responsibility beyond your narrow kind of ethno-national view of the country. And that means that in a way, Trump's wall is it's a kind of perverse symbolic tribute to the idea that our responsibilities are getting narrower at a time when the crisis is becoming more global and encompassing.
Well, our first guest today is a very preeminent psychiatrist who we were talking about Trump's meltdown in the Oval Office yesterday and how it's probably going to get even worse as the impeachment continues. It's only just started and he's acting a little unhinged. And he said, look, you know, forget about Trump and forget about our politicians because they're just not up to it. The Democrats are arguing amongst themselves and wasting a hell of a lot of money that they could be using in the general. And whoever they pick is going to be outspent massively by Wall Street and by big insurance, particularly if it's Elizabeth Warren. And they're going to be totally vilified by Fox News and the Trump world. So, you know, just get out in massive numbers. And I get the sense that that's more or less what you're saying, that the political clock is hopelessly out of sync and out of date, and that we as global citizens simply have to rise up.
Well, I do agree with that. I don't think, and I didn't take you to say, that we can avoid addressing the political class in the end. We need to change them. We need to replace them, and we need to put the ones who are there under a new kind of pressure. I do think that ultimately we're not going to be able to do this without marches, without mass mobilization, without cultural change. None of those things will be enough because the paradox, the irony of the modern state is that it's totally inadequate to what we need, but it's also the only thing that can change enough of our technological infrastructure and built environment and spending patterns fast enough to pivot. So we need a politics that's bigger, much bigger than standard politics, but it also needs to feed back into and change the shape of what's happening in Congress and in the White House and in international negotiations and so on.
So could you make the case then, in adding to what you're talking about, the denialists in the Trump world, that in effect we're all in lifeboat Earth together and, you know, it's leaking and we all have to bail continually and faster because it's getting worse and worse. And that in effect this requires cooperation, it requires a form of global patriotism that transcends nations and borders, because this is basically we're all in it together, everyone on this planet. So the fact that nationalism is being stoked by Trump and by the denialist, is that an adjunct to denial, nationalism?
That puts it really well. Yeah, I think that's right. Let me make a quick observation about lifeboats and then move right back to the heart of the question. The thing about lifeboats is sometimes people all bail together and sometimes they throw people overboard and sometimes they eat the other people on the lifeboat, right? So a lifeboat is an ethical crisis, and it needs a solidarity and it needs ways of cooperating for people to survive together rather than turn on each other. And that's actually this situation. We don't have nearly the political repertoire or institutions we need to deal with a problem on a global scale. And for exactly that reason, let me say, I think nationalism is an adjunct to denialism for exactly the reason you give. It is a way of saying that our political responsibilities are limited to the people who are supposedly our own kind. Though, of course, nationalisms are all made up to a considerable degree, very powerful myths. I think not all forms of patriotism are necessarily pernicious in that way. I think there are versions of feeling that you have a special responsibility for the harms and the history and the use of the power of your own country that can actually be mobilized at a time like this to say, we're not going to have the global politics we need tomorrow. We're not going to have it with strong institutional expression in 10 years. So this is another case where we don't have as much time as we need. So a lot of the action is just going to have to be on the platform of national politics. And we need to be thinking creatively about building politics on a national level that has an international orientation. And the one thing I think is hopeful when you look back at U.S. political history, different versions of what the country is about and what patriotism is all the way back to the beginning, they've always been linked with ideas about where about your responsibilities as an international citizen or as even as a global person. So we can have a version of that now. There was a Cold War version of that. There was a terrible racist imperialist version in the early 20th century. There was actually a pretty good version that people like Abraham Lincoln were involved in, a kind of international revolutionary republicanism in the small R sense. And we need a kind of radical, ecological, democratic internationalism now that is also a kind of American patriotism.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago, Jedediah, that you have a newborn, 1 month old, and that being new parents, you are now faced with the need for childcare, but at the same time, you have to work harder and longer to raise the money to pay for the childcare, and in doing so, you're denying yourself the time that you should otherwise be spending with this precious newborn that you have. And that, I think, gets at the heart of much of the paradoxes about that we go through, because we very rarely do we think about big thoughts about how we can rearrange society and rearrange the nature of work itself. Now, one of the presidential candidates, Andrew Young, is sort of, you know, scratching at the surface in some of those ideas. But do you think, along with what you brought to the table in terms of your new book, do you also think that we have to start thinking about bigger questions about how we rearrange our lives and our work lives? I mean, here in Los Angeles, for example, people spend hours a day sitting in traffic on freeways, polluting the air and wasting gasoline. It's just insane. So is that a part of the mix? In other words,
yes.
The idea that we've really got to rethink a lot, not just the glooming global warming crisis.
Yes, no, completely. The heart of the book is an idea, the moral heart of the book is an idea that I call commonwealth. And that idea at some level is simple. It's that the ways that the things that our economy treats as valuable and the kinds of work and activity that it rewards should be ones that help social life keep going. A theoretical way of saying it is they help social reproduction to happen. And they should be activities that keep the larger living world intact. And right now, it is exactly the opposite. Childcare makes the point really concretely. Instead of making it possible for people to spend a year at home taking care of their new child, we break up that good situation of parents and a child into a pair of stressful and expensive transactions. The parents off trying to get work done while they're tired and they're thinking about their kid and so on, and then a transaction with the childcare industry. So we should be reorienting social spending and, as you say, what counts as work in a way that rewards caretaking and rewards caregiving. We should be valuing nurses more. We should be valuing teachers more. We should be valuing all this kind of activity that just helps keep the human world going and doesn't necessarily involve blowing coal out of the ground or burning gas. Yeah, those are the things we should be valuing, because we need this. We need what you could say are like the microeconomics of personal decisions, what you you're driven to do to get by, what kinds of cost structure trade-offs you face in your daily life. Those need to have a logic that scales up to environmental sustainability and social sanity. And what we have now is in fact exactly the opposite.
So given the need for not just to deal with climate change in a radical and all hands on deck way, you're also arguing that we need to rethink work. We need to rethink, I guess, what capitalism was. I mean, how do you see the Green New Deal in that context? Because a lot of there's been a lot of criticism of it that it's asking for too much. Its scope is too wide. Right. It just should be narrowed on just environmental and not talking about universal health care, etc.
Right. I think that criticism has it exactly backward. I think the Green New Deal is hopeful and inspiring, especially in its stronger, more radical version, because it is actually the beginning of policy that's on the scale of the crisis. It says that we need to be redirecting our spending to making sure that people have living wages, doing non-polluting, non-extractive work, like taking care of the sick, like taking care of the young, like taking care of the elderly. It aims at the kind of security, economic security and dignity, that lets people start to relax the idea that the economy needs to be growing perpetually. I think as long as everyone is running scared in their economic lives and on some level feels that they never have enough to be safe, it's going to be that much harder to build up a politics that actually tries to relax our total demands on the earth and give it some space and take growth away from the top of our goals, at least for the rich countries in the world, and replace it with something like well-being or flourishing and looking out for one another. So the Green New Deal is not all of that, but it is a real beginning in that direction. The other thing it does that's so important is think about retooling all of our infrastructure, transport infrastructure, housing infrastructure, agricultural practices. That's so important because hard as we try as individuals to reduce our climate impact and so on, there are real limits on what individual virtue can do, because we are what I call in the book a species of infrastructure. Everything people do in our daily lives, we do in the setting of this huge built environment, a world of roads and buildings and cables and technology that for the average human being is 2,700 tons of built environment. That's like a shell that we're carrying around, if you think of us as crustaceans. And that just gets activated when we eat, when we're on the phone, even when we're in the subway, you know, certainly when we're in our cars. That is what determines the fuels that we burn up and the weight of our footprint on the earth. So we need to change that to change our environmental impacts. And that happens through the kind of visionary collective action that the Green New Deal points to.
So how much are we victims of a centuries-old myth that in many ways religion has also basically spurred and kept alive, this myth that, you know, our ancestors conquered the earth, that Christopher Columbus, all of these people, they went out and conquered these new lands. This is, we are, of course, speaking to each other in the new world, so to speak. Mm. Now we're at a point, you know, in other words, that we dominate nature, that it's our inevitable role to dominate nature, that is our sort of lot as the dominant species on the planet, not to live with nature, but to dominate it. Now that nature is dominating us, that we're having cyclones and tornadoes and hurricanes and floods and famine and stuff that we can't handle, where, you know, the insurance companies are going to go broke. Is there a recognition, or is there an ally, for example, in the insurance business? If the Koch brothers are our enemies, who are our allies?
In terms of the
in terms of the rich business
and powerful
world.
Yeah, industries and the like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whether we need them or not, I don't know. But I'm, but if they're willing to help, I'd say yes.
I guess part of the question is what the shape of your politics, of your program is. Here's what I mean, to be a little more concrete. If we're talking about building a green capitalism, then the renewable energies industries are a huge ally. Because they'll be angling to be the new British Petroleum. You know, not they won't be about owning the oil wells, but it'll be about controlling the technology for solar panels and wind and so on, and controlling the those grids. And that's very powerful because the energy industry, if it's a private industry, wherever it, whatever its form, is going to be a huge site of wealth. If we're thinking in more social democratic terms, or even kind of eco-socialist terms about moving to a more public vision of caregiving, then organizations like the nurses unions and the teachers unions that have been getting more and more militant and effective, maybe they're a central part of the story because they're at the heart of the idea that we need to turn what the economy values away from financial speculation and away from fossil fuel extraction and toward honoring the work of taking care of people, bringing the next generation up and helping the last generation in its last years. And that that's a kind of different picture. So I think there are going to be allies. And it sort of depends on the shape of the world you're trying to build. Then all of us who are not pathological, do care about whether the world goes on. And what Greta Thunberg and others are, and the Extinction Rebellion activists and so on, are calling for is for us to wake up to that and see that in some sense, as Barack Obama used to say, we're the people we've been waiting for if we would just realize that we have everything on the line.
And when Greta Thunberg spoke at the UN and inspired the global demonstrations around the world, I saw some of them here in Los Angeles, and I saw very young school kids, maybe, you know, under 10 years of age, holding up handmade but very, very poignant signs about how, you know, we've screwed up their future. Yes. And how we're sort of killing this. And let us live. I mean, it gets to the heart of so much. I sense that that could be a massively powerful political movement. We have never had anything along those lines in the history of this planet where such young people are mobilizing from the bottom up. And, of course, they all have parents. So do you see that as an organizational model, if you will? The young, the very young, start to educate the older generations all the way up from their older siblings to their parents, to their relatives, and to their grandparents.
It shouldn't be on them, you know. I don't blame is not the point at all. I honor Greta Thunberg being so angry at the fact that we've let them down up to this point. Absolutely. I think it's got to be reciprocal, right? Ultimately, it is the responsibility of the adults, and that's her point, actually. It's the responsibility of the adults to save the world and help the world go on. But I do think that if there's a new alertness and a kind of radicalism in very young people that comes from not having been acclimated to the idea that this is okay and that this is normal and that the world has to go on this way, then that's very powerful and that's what we need. This time needs a lot of things. It needs technological innovation. It needs political vision. It needs organizing. It also probably needs some prophecy. Radical politics has often had a very important aspect of prophecy, and it looks like that prophecies have to come from the margins, one way or another. And which margin is this coming from? It's coming from the margin of people who haven't been in the world long enough to have given into it. And that's a very powerful voice.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, to address what I began talking about earlier and that is the extent to which your book explores how we might begin to heal our fractured and contentious relationship with the land and with each other. During this upcoming election year and starting right now, the discourse is going to get more and more poisonous. The president's already invoking civil war. He will rile up his base. The more the impeachment closes in on him, the more likely he is to just lash out in ways that could be extremely alarming. How do you, in that environment, bring people together? Because, you know, I really believe that in many ways Trump is evil, and some of the people around him, his cabinet, the people now in Interior, just horrendous. Bernhardt, the guy that they've just put in at the Bureau of Land Management, hates public lands. He hates environmentalists. He wants it. He actively wants the land to be plundered. There is some bad people out there doing bad things. But somehow or other, we've got to heal this divide. So I know it's asking a lot, but what's your solution?
First, we have to win. And to win, we just need a majority plus the constitutional corruption that is the Electoral College. I say that because you win people over in part by beginning to build a new and better world that has a place for them. So I write in the book about the Appalachian coal fields. I grew up in West Virginia. My wife's grandfather was a union coal miner and his whole life until Black Lung killed him. And that used to be a very militant Democratic and in some ways a very militant progressive area. And that culture of militancy isn't gone, but it's been turned, ironically, into a pretty Trumpist force and certainly an anti-environmental force and a destructive one. The county I grew up in, which is just north of the coal fields, went for Trump almost 80% in 2016, and the coal fields also went very strongly for Trump. It's two steps. I don't think that in the campaign you win everyone over. I think that the ground is too poisonous and things are too bad and broken right now. But what you do in politics is first someone with vision, a Sanders, a Warren, or someone else, but someone who's pressed by activists and movements on the outside, and a Congress the same, takes power and then in good faith starts trying to make a world that has a future for people in Appalachia, has a future for people in declining agricultural regions. It also has a future for the new working class of color and immigrants in the coastal cities. It has a future of dignity for health workers. You have to bring people into a new solidarity and shared well-being in a concrete way. I think it's gone too far right now to do it just with words.
Well, just in closing, Jedediah Purdy, what would your invocation be to our audience since wrapping up your brand new book, This Land is Our Land, The Struggle for a New Commonwealth?
My invocation?
Yes. In other words, why should people get your book? Because you don't have to tell me why they should, but I'm in a situation where I have to be a salesman.
Gosh, it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. It's an uncomfortable thing to do for yourself. The book tries, throughout the book, I try to say in a concrete and unpretentious and honest way, and it's a short and tight book. I tried not to waste any space and not to waste any words. It tries to really cast some light into many questions at the heart of why our relation to the natural world is so tragic and so destructive right now, and to ask in a serious way what the scale of change would have to be to turn that around. And it tries to do that not just in a technical or academic or abstract way, but in a way that also talks about the moral core of our environmental and social politics, of why it's humanly valuable to try to make a world that is more shared, that's more common, and that can go on flourishing instead of one where we're wearing it down and wearing one another down just to keep living. So it's a kind of manifesto. It's a kind of concrete, practical account of where we are. And it's a book that really tries to find a personal voice to bring those things together. And I actually would love to have it read by people who are looking for that and to know whether it connects for them.
Well, it was an uncomfortable question, but a very elegant answer, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jedediah Purdy.
Ian, thank you so much for having me. It's good to talk to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Jedediah Purdy, who's a professor of law at Columbia Law School and a contributing writer at The New Yorker, The Nation, The New Republic, and The Atlantic. His books include After Nature, A Tolerable Anarchy, Being America, and his latest book just out is This Land Is Our Land, The Struggle for a New Commonwealth. We're going to take a brief station break and back speak with the author of the new book, We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from London is Mark Galeotti, who's one of the foremost Russia watchers today, who travels there regularly to teach, lecture, talk to his contacts, and watch the unfolding story of the Putin era. Based in London, he is a senior non-resident fellow at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, having previously headed its Center for European Security. He's a prolific author on Russia and security affairs and frequently acts as a consultant to various government, commercial, and law enforcement agencies. And his books include The Vory, Russia's Super Mafia, and his latest, We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Galeotti.
My pleasure to be here.
And it's hard not to keep reporting on Putin because he's sort of very much in Trump's shadow. The exact nature of their relationship has never been fully fleshed out, and it may well be in this upcoming impeachment. But obviously this Ukraine story now that's led to the impeachment of Trump has Putin as a subtext, I would say. But let's just start with what happened yesterday at the Russia Energy Week conference, where Putin was asked about the remarks by Robert Mueller that Putin not only interfered in the 2016 election, he's doing it now, and he will do it in 2020. And then Putin sort of theatrically pretended to sort of do a conspiratorial whisper and said, I'm going to tell you a secret. Yes, sure, we're going to do that. Don't tell anybody. And, of course, the audience have all laughed, etc. So this is not a laughing matter. For the life of me, I don't understand here in the United States why it's not the number one priority in this country to secure our elections, but that's another story. So how is this Ukraine situation playing in Russia, though? Because my understanding is that Zelensky is sort of getting under Putin's skin because he got freely and fairly elected. He's going after the oligarchs. He's trying to stop corruption. And my understanding is the Russians are looking at it and saying, my God, if they can do it right next door, why can't we do it?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't really overplay how ordinary Russians necessarily are looking at Zelensky. Now, the thing is, if Zelensky can pull it off, then that may well be a very problematic example for all, you know, for the Kremlin, because it'll actually show that it is possible to turn a country that is deeply corrupt and has the sorts of problems that Ukraine has, and yet make a go of it. But at the moment, it's still too early for that. I think the main issue from the Russians' point of view is they don't like the fact that it's very hard for them to predict exactly which way Zelensky's going to go. They got so used to dealing with old-style, corrupt Ukrainian presidents who are basically just in it for their bank accounts. And now they have someone who, because he's basically someone who no one really knows, he's absolutely trying to change things around. He's made some bad steps as well, but he's done a lot that is actually necessary. And the Russians are still trying to work out, is he for real? Is he going to crash and burn? And until they know that, they feel they can't kind of game plan what to do next.
Well, already he is apparently, the Ukrainians have given him a nickname. Their president Zelensky is apparently being called Monica Zelensky, which is a reference to the fact that he promoted or provoked an impeachment of a sitting American president. So I don't know whether that means it is. I mean, isn't that at the end of the day, the ultimate sort of fallback, certainly in Russian politics, to make fun of your leaders, even if you can't do anything about them?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, you might say humor's pretty much a sort of a natural constant of the political situation. And I think that there's a big difference between the kind of joke that is actually just meant to be entertaining and the kind of joke that is a jibe. And I think Zelensky at the moment still has very much the Ukrainian people behind him. There is a considerable degree of bemusement precisely about how things have happened because of this since leaked telephone conversation and how this has led to the indictment in the States. And perhaps a little bit of discomfort about the way that Zelensky was talking to Trump, even while people intellectually realize that if you're talking to a figure like Trump, you have to lay on the praise as thickly as you possibly can. And Zelensky was basically there with an earth mover doing that. But generally speaking, at the moment, Zelensky still has his country behind him.
So there's a rumor that there is a tape of the Ukrainian side of the conversation. In other words, they recorded. On the American side, they don't record. So as a legacy of Watergate, they do transcripts and have several people taking furious notes as the conversation proceeds. And the transcript that was released by the White House is clearly incomplete. It doesn't represent a half-hour conversation. So, but have you heard any rumors to the effect that there is tapes on the Ukrainian side, and given that there are essentially a bunch of novices in the Zelensky cabinet, there's a potential for them leaking out?
Yes, it's not so much because they're novices, but because, let's be honest, the Ukrainian sort of system is still fairly corrupt, and it's obviously largely it's civil servants who have the responsibility for these tapes. Yes, I've heard that there are these tapes, but I have to say I don't get the sense there's anything really else to add. Because, I mean, what we have to realize is the conversation between Trump and Zelensky was interpreted. Zelensky speaks some English, but not at the level of actually handling a full kind of hotline conversation. And that, I think, is really what seems to explain why there seems to be, shall I say, that much less text than you'd expect for a half-hour conversation.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm speaking with Mark Gagliotti, who is in the UK. He's one of the foremost Russian watchers today. He travels there regularly to Russia and to teach, lecture, talk to his contacts and watch the unfolding story of the Putin era. Based in London, he's a senior non-resident fellow at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, having previously headed its Center for European Security, and he's a prolific author on Russia and security affairs, and he frequently acts as a consultant to various government, commercial, and law enforcement agencies, and his books include The Vory, Russia's Super Mafia, and his latest book is We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong. So, having asked that question, Mark, can you give us an answer? I talked to all our Russian experts over the decades, and I could make the case that they basically get most of it wrong most of the time. But let's refer right to your book and ask that question: how the West gets him wrong.
Well, to an extent, it's because we've allowed Putin to basically create his own mythology in our minds. And that is a mythology of this ultra cool, macho, decisive ex-KGB secret agent who is in charge of everything. And he plays that. You referred at the, right at the beginning of this interview to his not so funny joke recently about meddling in American elections, because he's actually just, again, building up this image of himself as the guy who's behind the curtain, the guy who's behind all the various things that go wrong with the West. And I mean, in my book, I go through a whole bunch of the myths about Putin, but one that in some ways is most significant and most affects Western policy is the fact that absolutely he is not this grand strategist. He does not have some dark plan sitting in a drawer working out exactly what he's going to do next. He has a broad sense of where he wants to be. He knows that he wants the West divided. He wants to make Russia great again, as he would think of it. But he doesn't really have a grand plan of how to get there. He's not a chess player. Instead, I mean, his sport is judo. When you go into the ring in judo, you have a sense of your opponent's strengths and weaknesses, their signature moves, how you're going to respond to them. But basically, you're circling, looking for an opportunity. And that's Putin. He is the arch opportunist. And in a way, it's whenever we give him opportunities, that's when he strikes. And sometimes he'll be successful and sometimes he'll be unsuccessful. But the point is, the more we get tied up in trying to look for what is the master plan, a plan that does not exist, we actually miss the way that we empower Putin by giving him lots of smaller opportunities.
But you do write, you mentioned there that Putin has raised Russia up from its knees. But he also, as you say, sees the relations with the West as a zero-sum game in which the country's own interests can only be advanced by obstructing and subverting Western agendas. So does that mean that he sort of has that KGB mindset of Glavny Protivnik, of the main adversary? In other words, is he more focused on stitching us up here, particularly here in the United States, than helping his own country?
Well, I mean, in a way, he regards anything that stitches up the West as something that helps Russia. And I think this is in a way what we've seen happen over time. But when Putin first came to power, sure, he talked tough on nationalism, but actually he was very pragmatic. And these were his first two presidential terms were times which were actually pretty good for Russia. Exactly. He managed to bring back central authority. Ordinary Russians' lives got better. Since he came back from his brief period as kind of prime minister running a sock puppet president because of term limits, he seems to have come back believing his own mythology, believing of the fact that he has this kind of historic mission and that his historic mission is being held back by Russia. I think the thing is, Putin thinks that Russia is at war with the West because he thinks that the West is unfairly trying to keep Russia from its real potential. And the problem with wars is it only takes one side to start it. Now, it's not going to be a shooting war. It's a political war. But still, I think this is it. From Putin's point of view, it's easier to focus on trying to do down the West because his problems at home, they're about economics, they're about demographics, they're about pension schemes. They're complex, they're difficult, they haven't got an easy solution. So, like so many autocrats, he looks to create mischief abroad because he doesn't have any answers for the problems at home.
Well, but one of the reasons he has problems at home is that he's running a kleptocracy, is he not? And I mean, you say that, you quote one senior official who says that Putin doesn't go looking for money; money goes looking for him. Is that to say then that he's kind of the godfather of the godfathers? Is he regulating the kleptocracy? How does it work? Because my understanding is that the oligarchs and the Siloviki have been stealing the country blind, and he's clearly using some of these prominent oligarchs like Deripaska and others as cutouts to do. And you know, we could go into all of them, how they've gotten themselves embroiled in U.S. electoral politics, etc. But how does the system work, and how much is the kleptocracy a part of the problem in terms of the Russian economy?
It's a big part of the problem. I mean, there are all kinds of other structural problems, but it's suggested that maybe up to 40% of the Russian economy is either being stolen or else it's being sort of kept underground to avoid paying taxes and so forth. Now, this is a serious issue. The thing is, Putin, and I think this says something about his limitations. He, in some ways, he's very smart. In other ways, he's clearly not that smart. he has a very, very tribal, almost kind of gang notion about how he looks at the world and how he looks at people. He doesn't make friends easily, but those people he does make, he regards as being people who he will indulge them regardless. And so you look at the people at the very top of the system. I mean, these are the people who are embezzling on an industrial scale. And these are the guys who Putin has round, Putin plays ice hockey with, and so forth. And he doesn't genuinely seem to see that absolutely crucial distinction. He thinks of himself as a patriot, but at the same time, he's turning a blind eye to his friends robbing his country blind. And I think this is it. I think that's one of the reasons why, for all he's desperate to build his grand historic legacy and worried about how he's going to be written about in the history books, the histories are going to be really quite critical of him because of this fact that, having done a necessary job in his first couple of terms of sort of stopping this country from sliding into chaos, he's now presiding over the massive theft of the country.
Just referring back to your book, Mark Gagliotti, The Vory, Russia's Super Mafia, the Krisha, of course, the roof, is tribute that goes to the Godfather, right? How does that fit into this Putin methodology in terms of kleptocracy? Is he the ultimate roof?
He is the ultimate roof. If you're under his protection, you can get away, you know, probably quite literally with murder, but certainly metaphorically. The thing is, though, Putin doesn't need money. I mean, there's some talk about that maybe he's the richest man in the world. I'm skeptical about that, but he certainly is vastly rich. And more to the point, he's got all of Russia as his piggy bank. If he wants a yacht or a palace, he doesn't have to pay for it. He gets the state to do so. The real currency in Russia is political power. And that's what you pay him. You basically, you become an obedient crony of his. You provide him with what he wants. And if you do, he will look after you. And again, this links in, if we go, you know, link this back to what we've known about interference in American politics. Not just in terms of the sort of leaking of emails and things, which is clearly a government operation. But when you have these figures like the lawyer Veselnitskaya, Maria Butina, who was building close links with the NRA, and various other people. You mentioned Deripaska. It's not that Putin charges them and says, "You are my agent, go out and do X in the United States." It's they probably, more likely, they spot a potential opportunity because they know if they get some line into the White House or some other advantage, they can take that to Putin and he will reward them. So this is the situation. I mean, he's like the kind of, if you want to use this metaphor, he's the Godfather reclining at the back of his restaurant, waiting for people to come in with gifts. And if the gifts please him, he will reward them.
Well, let's just in the last couple of minutes turn to the mystery of this relationship between Trump and Putin. And it seems that it goes back a long way, certainly further than the writ that Mueller had in his terms of his investigation in the mid-80s. The Vory in Brighton Beach started to buy lots and lots of condos in Trump's property in cash. And there's some suggestion that maybe they were laundering the money stolen from the Soviet coffers by the KGB. In 87, he went to Moscow. And there are rumors that somehow they compromised him. Of course, they were back then, even in 87, they were dangling a Trump tower in Moscow. The minute he gets back to the U.S., he takes out four-page ads in the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Boston Globe talking about the dissolution of NATO. He makes a trial run for the president, and then you can just go through the many decades and up to the more recently since he's been in office. There's so many mysterious things going on. Just at the G7, apparently he ruined the dinner for all of the leaders there, the private dinner where they without their aides and spouses, and he just Trump just kept going on about bringing Putin back into the G8 to the point where the rest of the world leaders thought, my God, what does Putin have over this guy? And then, of course, the notes of their meetings have all disappeared, particularly the long meeting they had in Hamburg, where Trump literally grabbed the notes from the translator and put them in his pocket. So You've studied this relationship in depth. What do you think it's about, and how would you describe it?
Well, it's a variety of things. I mean, there is this bizarre pathology of Trump's that he doesn't seem to have met a dictator or an autocrat that he doesn't love. It's not just Putin. It's everyone from Duterte to Xi Jinping to whoever. Secondly, there is the fact that certainly, again, I mean, I'm very cautious because we live in litigious times. But certainly, I mean, I've spoken to law enforcement officers who absolutely say that the Trump organization was notorious and still is for not really caring where the money comes from. As long as it's not ridiculously obvious that it's criminal proceeds, they are very happy to take it. So, which means that, yes, we've seen Russian gangsters buying Trump properties and so forth. And we've also seen gangsters from all over the rest of the world. I mean, essentially, it's a whole United Nations of criminality that we see finding its way sort of into doing deals with the Trump organization. Now, since then, I mean, clearly the Russians are going to use every potential lever. We shouldn't think for a minute that they regarded Trump as being some great asset from the first. Even right back during the presidential election, yes, they were happy to use Trump as they thought of it as a weapon against Hillary Clinton, of whom they were terrified. But there wasn't really any expectation that he was going to win the election. If anything, the Russians thought that the American system was too sort of controlled, frankly. I remember one Russian foreign ministry staffer saying there is no way the American establishment will let a Trump win. And then when he did win, frankly, they were shocked and they didn't know what to do. But what they have done, like so many other leaders, is they have learned the new rules of the game. How do you play Trump is one of the new sort of crucial diplomatic skills. We saw that in the conversation between Zelensky and Trump. And likewise, the Russians are trying to work out ways of basically appealing to his vanity, working out ways of wooing him. Again, I think not because they have any long-term trust in him. They know that essentially he will go for whatever is the most recent shiny novelty being dangled in front of him. But nonetheless, they're going to do their bit to manipulate him. So I think it's a combination of things. It's someone who clearly has a long-established record of not, frankly, adhering to a particularly strong moral code, if I can put it that way. Someone who anyway appreciates authoritarian leaders and likes being in their company. And the Russians specifically being very hard-nosed, very clever about this, and working out how best do you play this individual who has found himself in the Oval Office.
Well, Mark Gagliotti, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Gagliotti. He's in the UK. He's one of the foremost Russia watchers today. He travels there regularly to teach, lecture, and talk to his contacts and watch the unfolding story of the Putin era. He's based in London, and he's a senior non-resident fellow at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, having previously headed its Center for European Security. And he's a prolific author on Russia and security affairs and frequently acts as a consultant to various government, commercial, and law enforcement agencies. And his books include The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia, and his latest book is We Need to Talk About Putin, How the West Gets Him Wrong. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and engineer D'Angelo Jones. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.